by Blackalicious. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is a free man, home in Australia. He landed in the capital of Canberra in a charter jet from Saipan, where a U.S. district court judge sentenced him to time served after he pled guilty to a single felony count of illegally obtaining and disclosing national security material. We just played excerpts of the news conference with his wife, Stella Morris Assange, and his lawyers. For more, we're joined here in New York by Jamil Jaffer, director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. He was previously the ACLU's deputy legal director. His piece is In Just Security, is headlined The Assange Plea and Press Freedom. And in the capital of Australia, where Julian Assange just landed, Canberra, we're joined by Peter Whish-Wilson, Australian Greens Senator for Tasmania in the Australian Federal Parliament since 2012. He co-founded the Bring Julian Assange Home Parliamentary Group. We are going to begin with you, Peter Whish-Wilson, in Canberra. If you can talk about the response to Julian Assange being freed and what it meant. I mean, we saw today news conferences of the prime minister, who made this a top issue when he met with President Biden. If you can talk about this with Prime Minister Albanese and what it took to free Julian Assange.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. Look, it's a big deal here. It's been splashed across the media in Australia the last 24 hours. The fact the Prime Minister's done two press conferences in the last 24 hours on this, it's taken a really big campaign, a really big grassroots campaign by thousands of people in Australia, indeed millions of people around the world, to bring this to the attention of politicians. It's taken a long political pathway here in Australia. We established a cross-parliamentary friends group 6 years ago. There was only two of us when we started. It's got over 60 members now, and we have good representation across the Australian Parliament. We've seen the House of Representatives, our version of Congress, pass a motion voting unanimously for Julian Assange to be freed. And, of course, last time I spoke on Democracy Now! I was in Washington with a cross-party delegation, an unusual delegation of politicians from Australia who were meeting with senators and Congress people in the US. We met with the Department of Justice. We met with the State Department and other stakeholders to plead the case to drop the extradition and free Julian Assange. So it's been a long road for a lot of people. And, of course, none of this could have happened if we hadn't have changed government in Australia just over 2 years ago. The new Labor government, with Anthony Albanese as our Prime Minister, had done a lot of work behind the scenes. And I think it's very fair to name up the fact that our ambassador to the US, Kevin Rudd, the previous Prime Minister here in Australia, has played a pivotal role in this outcome, as has our UK High Commissioner, Stephen Smith, in the UK. So I think it's our government showed a lot of conviction and courage. I wasn't sure they had it in them a few years ago, but they have. They've been consistent. There's been a lot of quiet diplomacy behind the scenes. And I can tell you, people here are very relieved. It still feels a bit surreal and a bit overwhelming after such a long campaign. But more than two-thirds of Australians in recent polls, in fact, higher numbers than that, have supported bringing Julian Assange home. So, yes, it's a very big deal.
And Senator, I wanted to ask you, when you went to Washington in last September, did you expect that your diplomacy would bear this fruit so quickly? And do you think the enormous support of the Australian public and the Australian government, especially given how the United States, in its pivot to Asia, is increasingly reliant on an alliance with Australia in the region, did that have an impact as well?
Look, I think the close relationship between our two countries has been very important in getting this outcome. The US ambassador to Australia, Carolyn Kennedy, made a public statement tonight that they welcome Julian Assange's return home to Australia. Obviously, I find that a bit rich. As someone who's campaigned to free Julian, he should never have been put in this situation in the first place. We've obviously had a win for Julian and his family in the last 24 hours, but it hasn't been a win for journalism and free press. When we came to the US, I think what surprised us, I think I chatted to you the very morning we arrived, but when we left, what surprised us was that some of the key institutions like the Department of Justice hadn't really cottoned on to just how much public sentiment had changed in Australia. A number of things that happened in Australia in recent years. We've had our own war crimes trials and disclosures. Our special forces, the kind of things they've been getting up to in Afghanistan, which shocked our nation. And it also showed us the value of whistleblowers, and how that information came to light was really important. There's been a number of factors that have led to a change in sentiment here towards freeing Julian Assange. So I think these all played a role. But, I suppose it has happened quickly in some senses, Ron, but, given how sick Julian Assange has been, the significant concerns we've had for his health, I think we were very anxious to get an outcome as quickly as possible. I do think you heard it in the extracts from the press conference there. I think we felt that once the UK High Court, only a few weeks ago, had decided to hear a full appeal against Julian Assange's extradition on substantive grounds, not just very kind of narrow legal scope, which we'd seen in previous court cases, was probably what shifted the dial where the US, came to the table. So, we're glad it's all over, but, 5 years in solitary confinement in Belmarsh Prison, and many years prior to that in solitary confinement in an embassy. It's been a very long road for Julian Assange, and I'm a bit emotional at the moment, so you'll have to forgive me, but we're very glad he's home.
Now, I'd like to bring in Jamil Jaffer into the conversation, director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. Jamil, your reaction to the latest news and Julian Assange's freedom, and specifically if you could talk about the impact of the High Court decision in the UK on May 20th that probably pressured as well the U.S. government to reach a deal.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what ultimately persuaded the U.S. government to make this deal. I do think it's a great thing for press freedom that we have avoided a judicial ruling from an American court on the scope of the Espionage Act and the scope of the First Amendment, because from the beginning there has been this real concern among press freedom advocates about the possible implications of this case for journalism. The indictment charges, the indictment that included multiple counts under the Espionage Act charges Julian Assange with having solicited government secrets and having published government secrets. Those are things that journalists do all the time, that news organizations need to do if they are going to play the role that we want them to play in our democracies. And so, the concern was always that if this case went to an American court would rule or might rule that the Espionage Act made that kind of activity illegal and that the First Amendment didn't protect that kind of activity. And that would have had, catastrophic implications for Julian Assange, but it would have also had catastrophic implications for press freedom more broadly. So we have avoided that possibility, and that is something worth celebrating. One thing I would add, though, is I don't think this is an unmitigated victory for press freedom, because we do still have this plea agreement in which Julian Assange essentially agrees that he has spent 5 years in custody for the kinds of acts that journalists engage in, again, all the time. And while this plea agreement doesn't have the same kind of judicial sanction that a judicial opinion on the scope of the Espionage Act and the scope of the First Amendment would have, it still is a kind of political precedent. It's a precedent that some future administration could point to in bringing this kind of case again. And it's a precedent that other countries can and inevitably will point to justify their own abuses relating to press freedom. So not an unmitigated victory, but still we've averted press freedom catastrophe, I would say.
And Jamil, you heard Stella Morris Assange, Julian's wife and also a human rights lawyer. That last clip we played where she said we are now seeking a pardon. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, this is on Julian Assange's record, right? There is a conviction that, you know, has a kind of formal legal status, and a pardon would vacate that conviction. You know, in terms of the legacy of this case for press freedom, I do think it would be better if this case had never been brought in the first place. You know, that's I think.
And this was a bipartisan affair from one administration to the next. They charges against Julian Assange.
That's true. Although, as you know, it is it's a complicated story because the Obama administration considered bringing these charges, decided against it because they were concerned about the implications for press freedom. The Trump administration then filed the charges,
even though President Trump, when he was running for president, said, "I love WikiLeaks," repeatedly.
That's right. But, you know, I think that President Trump saw the press freedom implications as a positive thing about this case. You know, part of the reason the Trump administration wanted to bring this case was because they saw it as an opportunity to curtail press freedom. And then the Biden administration inherited the case, but then pursued the extradition for 3 years. So, yes, it's bipartisan, but it's a complicated story. My guess is that the Biden administration will be thrilled to have this case behind them. I don't think that they wanted this case to be part of their legacy in the way that the Trump administration did.
Jamil, if that is so, why did they pursue it? Even though, for instance, the Biden administration announced in 2022 that it was going to limit the use of subpoenas against the press.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they should have pursued it. And my institute, the Knight Institute, repeatedly asked them to drop the charges. But it is also true that the Biden administration resolved this case yesterday. And I think that's a sign that the Biden administration didn't want the case to be part of its legacy. I don't want to give the Biden administration too much credit here because they did require Assange to agree to plead guilty to an Espionage Act charge. And as I said, that that plea agreement creates a kind of political precedent. This is the first time that the Justice Department has successfully held a publisher liable under the Espionage Act. And that is a precedent that I think will be used by future administrations, and it's a precedent that will be used by other countries,
Jamil,
as well.
Is interesting as this case begins to be resolved, and Julian Assange is a free man, though he had to plead guilty to publishing what was called illegally publishing national security information. You have Evan Gershkovich in Russia, right, who's charged with attempting to publish state secrets. There's an interesting parallel here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, part of the concern about this case, the Assange case, is that it made it a lot more difficult for American government officials to champion press freedom in other contexts. And I think, you know, Evan's case is one of them. There are many others in which the message of the American government in favor of press freedom is complicated by the government's own actions in this particular case.
If people want to see all our interviews with Julian Assange over the years, back to when he was wearing an ankle bracelet and under home arrest, when we went to London to speak with him, then in the Ecuadorian embassy for 7 years, finally for 5 years, he was in the Belmarsh prison. You can go to democracynow.org. We want to thank Jamil Jaffer, Knight, First Amendment director at Columbia University, and Peter Wish Wilson, Australian Greens senator who co-founded the Bring Julian Assange Home parliamentary group, speaking to us from Canberra, the capital of Australia. When we come back, at least 22 people have been killed in Kenya's police opened fire Tuesday on growing protests against a bill to raise taxes. We'll speak with a number of people, along with President Obama's half-sister, Alma Obama, who was tear-gassed by the police yesterday in the streets. Stay with us.
President, who do we call it by the name? The finance bill are pushing the people in my shame. The tax system high, the burden still the same. We say no, President, who do you need to change again? From the hills and I recruit the coast of Mombasa. The people, they might try, they might ball, they might cross, yeah. The tax system oppressive, the burden too much. We have to make a stand, we have to stay in touch. The farmers, they must struggle, the vendors, they must fight. The mothers and the fathers, they must pray for light. The finance bill push, if not do the right. President Ruto, we call him for the people plan. President Ruto, we call him by the name. The finance bill pushing, the people, they must shame. The taxes, them high, the burden still the same. We said no, President Ruto. You need to change again. The youth, they need a future. The elders need rest. But the tax system, I little life in a mess. President Ruto, you hear the people stress. We now can take it, we demand the best. The workers, them are tired. The business, them are close. The pressure upon the people, it arise like a rose. The finance bill push, it can bring wars. President Ruto, you need to know how it goes. President Ruto, we call it by your name. The finance bill pushing, the people, them are shame. The tax system, I the burden still the same. We say no, President Ruto, you need to change again. From the hills and Nairobi to the coast of Mombasa, the people them are crying.
No, sir. Reject Finance Bill by Daddy Blessing. It's become an anthem of the Kenyan movement against a bill that has just been passed. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Kenya, at least 22 people have been killed, dozens more injured, as nationwide protests intensify after lawmakers approved a contested finance bill Tuesday that would hike taxes. Police fired live rounds, rubber bullets, tear gas at thousands of protesters who stormed Kenya's parliament in Nairobi, angered by the measure, which would skyrocket the cost of goods and services in Kenya to help pay off billions in foreign debt, including the International Monetary Fund and World Bank.
What the government did to deploy a lot of force on us, it wasn't good. Yeah, we are not happy about it because they killed our colleagues and fellow youths. It's not okay. It's very bad. We are demonstrating peacefully. It's our right to demonstrate.
Demonstrations also continued in other parts of Kenya, including the coastal city of Mombasa.
The taxes are so high. We are being taxed our salary, and any other thing that you are going to buy with the little that you are remaining with is also taxed. So I think let us just demonstrate. We don't want it to be amended. We want it to be rejected in totality.
This comes as 400 Kenyan soldiers arrived in Haiti Tuesday, the first contingent of U.S.-backed troops sent to combat worsening gang violence in Haiti. Many Haitians have opposed the mission, saying past international interventions have contributed to political destabilization and humanitarian crises in Haiti. For more, we're joined by a number of people in Nairobi and beyond. Faith Odhiambo is with us, president of the Law Society of Kenya. We're also joined by Mamka Anyona, who is international finance and development expert from Kenya, who is joining us today from Kigali, Rwanda. And in a moment, we'll be joined by Alma Obama, the Kenyan-British community activist, sociologist, and author, and half-sister of former U.S. President Barack Obama, tear-gassed yesterday in the protests. But we're going to stay in Nairobi. Faith Odhiambo, thank you for joining us. Explain what these protests are about. We talked about the number of people killed, perhaps 22. It could be more. We don't know how many people have been disappeared. The president, Ruto, who actually just went to Washington to meet with President Biden, is also calling out the U.S., is calling out the Kenyan military.
Well, the protest started with regards to the proposed new finance bill 2024. And it started with discussions on what the bill is about, what it would mean on the cost of living, and all the taxes, both excise duty, VAT, as well as increase of tax in so many goods. And so I think the movement started that we should not have this finance bill. We're already raising over a number of billions with the old finance bill 2023, which was equally difficult for Kenyans to embrace. But at that time, we recognized that the country was not doing well, and we needed to pay a bit more taxes to ensure stability. But this new bill is quite heavy on the people, to raise an extra 302 billion, which would mean those who even in Kenya now, we have people who live in a dollar in 2 or 3 days. So it means that certain people are going hungry, and there's no much substantial amount going into budgets, going into the budget, going into education, going into development of industry. We see more budget going to unconstitutional offices. We have the office of the first, the wife of the president. Then we have the wife of the deputy president. Then we have the wife of the prime minister, which are all unconstitutional offices. And the government is spending hundreds of millions allocating funds to those offices. Then we have renovations that are being done to the office of the president and the vice and the deputy president, which Kenyans are saying this is wanton wastage. And then we see the opulent lives led by some of the cabinet secretaries close to the president. They have been in office coming now to this will be their second year. And yet when you see the way they live, it does not amount, you cannot account for their lifestyles. It's obvious corruption, and we see as well there are several corruption cases that come and there's no government action by the executive. And these are loans, and we are raising more money to pay those loans which disappear in corruption. So once the Kenyans started analyzing what it means in the healthcare sector, we've changed the healthcare care system, making it more expensive for Kenyans with less services, cutting out a huge number, particularly the youth, in receiving certain healthcare services, even scanning in terms of cancer. And so people are realizing the government is on a money-making mission. No one is caring for the people. No one is caring about the healthcare sector. No one cares about the education sector. No one cares about the small and medium-sized business. We've had quite a number of businesses moving out of the country last year, and so many businesses closing down. And the most funny thing was, I remember the chair of the Finance and Budget Committee, when people were presenting views and what this bill would mean to business, and was saying then, just leave the country and go and set up in another country. So it shows that we don't care as long as we raise money.
We also have Faith of the Honorable. We also have joining us Alma Obama, the half sister of former President Barack Obama, who participated in the protest and was tear gassed recently. Welcome to Democracy Now! And could you talk to us about why you participated in the protest and what happened?
Well, thank you for having me. I participated because in my work, I work for children and young people, in other words, the Gen Zs in my foundation, and also my staff are 60% Gen Zs and millennials. So I had to be there because I have to represent the voice of those young people, because that is what my foundation is called, Sautiku Foundation, which means powerful voices. On a personal level, I was there because I also feel strongly that there are items in the financial bill that are not for the benefit of the Kenyan people. The Kenyan people are struggling, especially the young people. We have over 50% of people who are not in work. They have no jobs, but they're going to be taxed, and then we'll end up having debt to the government. We have ancestral homes that are now being we're having the feeling that we're being threatened because there are taxes that are being introduced that will force our grandmothers and our great-grandparents and our parents to pay for the land that they've lived on for thousands of years. These considerations have to be taken to see how Kenyans can cope with such taxes. We need to create jobs before we start taxing people. We need to show what we're doing with our taxes before we start taxing people so people can be on your side. You have to listen to the people, and especially the young people, because it is their future, and they're seeing the mess we're making of this future. And that's why I'm there. I was there as what I'm calling a Gen Wazee, because Wazee means old people in Kiswahili. We are the generation of old people who made that mess. And if we need to fix it, we need to have the young people on board. And that is why I was there. And the fact that I was tear gassed was just a side, you know, effect. It's what they're going through daily. They're being directly targeted with water, with tear gas, with live bullets, with rubber bullets. They've been killed walking the streets for us in order for our country to be a better country. So to be honest, I could not have not been there to answer your question.
And Alma Obama, can you talk about the IMF pressuring the Kenyan government to enact these so-called fiscal reforms? Talk about the debt and what should happen to it in Kenya, why it's even called a debt.
I think the debt is irresponsible, and it's a pattern that is continued again and again on our continent in the different countries. Why would you give somebody who has no way to pay you back a loan? None of us would do it if we have, you know, if we're thinking sensibly. We're running our countries on debt. We're running our countries knowing full well that our communities, our people do not have the financial power to have enough money to put into our coffers to pay off that debt. So why would we get indebted? Why are we such an expensive country to run when the majority of people are so poor? That's the question that we need to ask. That's the question our people who loan us money should be asking themselves. We are not a viable society as yet to have such big debts. And this is what the young people are asking. They're not stupid. They can do the maths, and they're asking, why would we have such a high debt when we don't have good health care, when we don't have quality education, when we don't have roofs over our heads? It doesn't add up. And this is the question being asked and the question everybody's asking. So our leaders need to be more responsible. Our leaders must learn to say no, as the young people are saying no. The thing about this demonstration, the thing about this protest is not to threaten the leaders. The young people do not want to lead. They do not want our leaders to actually even leave. Now they want them to leave because they are fed up. But in reality, what they want is our leaders to be responsible leaders that are thinking of the benefits for the Kenyans. They must work for us because we put them there. We employ them. And that is where humility is needed on the part of the leaders to say, let me talk with my young employers. Let me talk with the people who put me here and ask them what it is that they need. And they can do the maths. Do not indebt us and then expect us to pay back a debt that you have created without putting us at the table to be part of the decision-making
We just have 30 seconds. Of course, you have close connections to the United States, your half-brother, President Obama. Ruto, the president of Kenya, just in Washington, getting tremendous support from President Biden. What do you want the U.S. government to say right now?
I'm sorry, I can't speak for that. And just to make it clear, my brother is not my half-brother. He's just my brother. We don't do halves in Kenya. I can't speak for the U.S. politics. I can only talk for the young people here and what's happening in my country. I'm so sorry. On that level, I'm really not political. I just can talk about what's going on in Kenya.
Well, we
I think the U.S. knows what they need to do.
We certainly will continue to cover this issue. Alma Obama, thank you so much for being with us, sister of former U.S. President Barack Obama, and Faith Odhiambo, president of the Law Society of Kenya. Thank you both joining us from Nairobi. We have a development director job opening at Democracy Now! Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain.